Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I know most of you are still eating, and some of you aren't eating yet, but in the interest of getting through a very full program before people start having to drift off, I thought I would at least give you a few words of welcome to begin with. This is a somewhat unusual meeting of the Policy Council on India. It is the largest audience we have had in this particular series. And it's a subject that I've been trying to put together for the past year and a half, because I think the basic focus of our discussions this afternoon is really important both to the future energy markets in the world and to the future of U.S.-India relations, which, as you know, is a subject near and dear to my heart. For those of you who are new to CSIS, I'm Tazi Schaefer, and I direct the South Asia program here. We have a very distinguished lineup of speakers here, and unfortunately, it should have been even more distinguished. But Ambassador Tom Pickering, who is one of the co-chairs of this group, called this morning to say that his wife has had back surgery, and so he has to stay home and compensate for her not being able to move, basically. And Ron Summers, who was to have spoken on the first panel this morning, is stuck in Maine with some kind of plane difficulties. But happily, he has sent a wonderful substitute in the person of Ted Jones, who also works at the U.S.-India Business Council, and who has just completed a major study of what the international energy industry would like to see by way of policy reforms in India. So let me welcome you with great enthusiasm to this meeting of the U.S.-India Policy Council. I would like to introduce our other co-chair, Michael Gadbaugh, whom I'm hustling through his lunch in very inhospitable fashion. But Mike, as many of you know, worked at General Electric for many, many years, retired last winter. He is now, I think he now has several different incarnations, but one of them is at Georgetown Law School. To my great pleasure, he continues to be interested in things Indian and in our program. I'm most grateful to him for taking the time to be with us today and would like to give him the opportunity to say a few words of welcome.
Is it working up here?
Yes.
If I push that button. Well, thank you, Tezi, and welcome to all of you. It is truly a delight for me to welcome so many of my colleagues and friends from across the decades that I've been working on India and on energy issues. It's pretty clear that word has gotten out either about the quality of the discussions in the council or about the quality of Tezi's cooking. Or most likely about both, but I'm very much encouraged by the turnout today. It testifies to the ongoing interest in this subject. For me, energy and India have been going together really since the early 90s when I got involved with India in connection with a Business Week article that featured India on the cover as one of GE's most important markets. And it was a time when the Indians were feeling quite left out of the Washington scene. And they actually came to Washington in the persons of Tarun Das and Jamshed Gadrej and said, how do we get more attention to India? And some of us got together and put together a little group called the India Interest Group. And we spent a fair amount of time traveling to India and had the pleasure of hosting the first real roundtable by business and government back when the Prime Minister came with his entourage, which included Manmohan Singh and Mantek Ahluwalia. And we had really the first face-to-face discussion between business and the Indian government that I think had ever been held over at the Willard Hotel, an appropriate forum for that kind of discussion. Since then, of course, as everyone knows, the paths of our two countries have become even more intertwined. And energy has been really at the core of that relationship. We have solved problems like the Dabhol issue, and those turbines are now up and running and providing power generation desperately needed in India. And we have the issue of the nuclear agreement, which has been so difficult and nettlesome, really in part because of its complexity, because it testifies to a new and different future for both India and the United States and all of those concerned about nuclear development and nuclear nonproliferation. But we see some signs, as those of us that have been hopeful around this agreement have been looking for, some signs that indeed there may be a pathway to achieving this historic agreement that will put the U.S.-Indian relationship and the Indian relationship across the world on a new footing. So I think the issues we confront today in this session are as important as any we have ever addressed in this council. And I'm delighted to welcome you all to this discussion and look forward very much to hearing from our panelists. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. And let me now turn the proceedings over to my colleague, David Pumphrey, who will introduce and moderate the first panel on India's energy sector.
Good afternoon, everybody. As Tezi had said, I'm with the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. But for many years, and many of you know this, I worked at the Department of Energy in the International Office. And one of the really very interesting areas that I worked on was on our relationship in energy with India. And so it is really a great pleasure to be here and to be able to introduce the panelists we have to talk about the energy situation and the energy directions for India in the future. Energy markets, and this is one of the concerns for our program now, energy markets are undergoing very fundamental changes, and I think we can see that now with the price of oil rapidly approaching $150 a barrel. I think when I was checking this morning, we're up to about $146. So we can see that there is tremendous change underway. In addition, there is a strong focus around the world on how we deal with the issue of climate change. Bringing both of these issues together is a topic that we're looking at very closely, and I think it's one that will be confronting energy policymakers for the next several years. If you look underneath the issues that are driving these trends, you see that one of the most important factors has been the growth in developing countries, particularly India and China. The IEA has released last year its latest World Energy Outlook, and they're projecting that about 45% of the growth in energy consumption through the year 2030 will be in two countries alone, India and China. So understanding the issues that will drive that growth there, the actions that are being taken in those countries will help us understand implications for our energy security and for climate change. So I think it's really terrific that we have the two speakers that we've got. Lena Srivastava, did I get that right? Okay, thank you. I've been worried about that all day, is the executive director of what I think is probably one of the most important energy research organizations in India, the Energy and Resources Institute, TERI. And my first trip to India was one of the stops that I made, and was actually one of the best stops I could have made to understand what is going on in India and the recommendations being made for the policy framework that will help guide the growth and address the challenges. TERI is an independent not-for-profit research institute that is looking at this energy, environment, and sustainable development nexus. Dr. Sivastava holds additional charge as the dean of the Faculty of Policy and Planning for TERI University since the year 2000. She's a PhD in energy economics from the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore. Number of publications, and I think hopefully the bio will be available to you. But I think that her background, the perspective that she brings, and especially the work that she has done with the Planning Commission in the Government of India and looking at the planning process is very important. One of the key issues that I saw in India was the lack of the comprehensive cross-cutting approach to developing energy policies. Of course, we in the United States have had some issues with that ourselves, but the Planning Commission has taken on this task to try to integrate together the different pieces. So I think her work in working on that integrated energy policy should be very good for providing us insights on the energy situations. Doctor, you can stop. Wherever you would like.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson. Let me start by thanking Ambassador Schaefer for this very kind invitation to me to come and share with you my perspectives on the Indian energy scenario and why we are where we are and where we are likely to be going from here on. It's been very exciting times in the recent few months, partly because of the oil price increases that we have seen and the consequences that has, the repercussions of that we have felt in the country, as also because of this enormous debate that has taken place in the political circles, in particular in the country, on the civil nuclear cooperation deal that the U.S. and India have been discussing for some time now. We are still a little unsure whether our current government would actually be able to get the right numbers to be able to survive the Prime Minister's endorsement of the civil nuclear deal and going to the IAEA, but I guess that remains to be seen as what happens in the next 2 weeks, really. I was also mentioning prior to our meeting over here that the kind of price increase that we have seen in international oil prices in the last 3 or 4 months is the equivalent of a $100 tax on carbon, something that again has been discussed time and again and has been set aside as saying as is practically not possible for several countries. But the IPCC in the fourth assessment report had actually equated a $50 tax on carbon to be equivalent to a $25 increase in price of crude oil. And we have seen well over a $50 increase in price of crude oil. But so that implicit tax is definitely there. How we respond remains to be seen. Whether people view it as a mechanism through which to bring about carbon efficiencies still remains to be seen. Anyway, since my presentation is now up, I will move to sharing some slides with you. The purpose of these slides is really to lay the groundwork to hopefully try and improve the understanding of the Indian energy situation and, as I said, why we are doing what we are doing. And hopefully the rest of what you may want to see can come up in discussions as well. I wanted to start by saying that India is not unique. We often stand up in international conferences and say that we have our huge development challenges. So I guess all countries have development challenges one way or the other, but the magnitude is what is worrisome, especially for a country the size of India. Population is huge, and it's often been pointed out that it's a serious cause of concern. We are the fifth largest country in terms of primary energy consumption. More importantly, from a developmental challenge point of view, 72% of our population continues to live in rural areas with very basic services that are provided to them. And 35% of our total population continues to be below the poverty line. And, of course, the definitions of poverty lines vary. But if you take the World Bank definition, then it is 35%. If you take the Indian definition, as we'll come to in a little while, it's a little more optimistic on this front. So the challenges as we are looking at it within the country, which determines how we are going to respond to the situation, focus around several areas. One, of course, is population growth, and we don't expect this to stabilize before 2060, and that would be at a level of 1.6 billion. That's almost 600 million more people than what we are talking about today. And this is because of the demographic characteristics that exist in the country. As I said, the Indian government believes that it's only 26% of our population which lives below the poverty line, and definition varies from a monetary value to a nutritional value that we are looking at, and that's why it's about 26%. But we aim to have poverty eradication by the year 2015. Life expectancy has improved in terms of health performance, but I think we still have a very high infant mortality rate, and I think important for us is to recognize the fact that 20% of the burden of disease is due to environmental health factors, and a large part of this is also because of indoor air pollution that is caused by large-scale biomass burning for meeting household energy requirements. Major challenges in the provision of other basic services. Only 70% of people in urban areas have access to basic sanitation services. Infrastructure is a huge challenge, and I think we still continue to have road as the major dominant form of providing mobility services. And the government, of course, has been investing also a fair amount of resources into the development of the highways network, both at the national level and at the state level. And this is primarily, again, to provide access to rural India to markets through which they can improve their own livelihoods. This is the kind of a vehicular growth pattern that we have seen in the last few years, and you'll see a huge increase in the population of two-wheelers that has, followed by cars and buses. And the key challenge, I think, over here remains with the fact that public transport infrastructure in the country is extremely poor. Just one or two cities have a proper mass transport system in the form of metros. Buses are available in very small numbers and form just about 1% of the total vehicular fleet, and which is why for those of you who have visited India and have traveled at cities, you'll find terribly overcrowded buses in very poor condition. So this is one of the big challenges, which is not allowing us to change the pattern of transportation. And transport sector is a huge contributor to energy demand and also to carbon emissions, as we are well aware. Air pollution is the other major challenge, and air quality remains a major concern. 84% of our population is exposed to poor, bad, or dangerous air quality. That's huge once again. And particulate matter continues to be a major source of the poor air quality. And this is just to say that, if you look at some of the large and medium-sized cities in the country, it may not be very visible to you, but the graph at the top talks about the industrial area standards with the line at the top over there. And the graph at the top talks about particulate matter, and the one below that on respirable particulate matter. And the point of this particular chart is to say that in most cities, we are way above the standards that have been established for residential areas. And in several of the cities, even above the standards air pollution standards that have been established for industrial areas. So this is the reason why a large percentage of our population is subjected to poor quality air. With that kind of a background, quick introduction to the country and the challenges that it faces, I'd like to move to the energy sector by saying that the macro picture that all of us see and that we are concerned about, that Ambassador Humphrey also pointed out, is this: the fact that energy consumption in India is going to increase rapidly in the coming few decades. And as we will see, may not be too apparent once again at the distance, but a large part of our energy as we see it today would still continue to be met by coal even up to the year 2030. So not only is commercial energy supply going to increase fairly rapidly, but correspondingly emissions of greenhouse gases are also going to increase fairly rapidly unless we do something drastic to correct this particular situation. This is a business as usual scenario, as you may have guessed. That's a macro scenario. If you look at the ground reality, again, it comes back to the issue of challenges. I think access to energy services continues to remain the major challenge that the government faces. More than 75% of rural and 22% of urban households still depend on wood as a primary source of cooking. We have not been able to provide cleaner petroleum fuels to most of the people in rural areas and the millions of people who live in slums in urban areas as well. And that's the reason for the very high level of indoor air pollution that I referred to earlier, and of course the consequent health damages, which are very severe. 57% of our rural population has no access to electricity. They do not have an electricity point that comes into their household, and this translates to almost about 400 million people. So it's not a mean number that we are talking about. Even in those areas where we do have access to electricity, the shortages are huge. The quality and reliability of electricity supply has a long way to go. We have peak and energy shortages of 13.5% and 9.9% respectively, which are again very large. Even in a city like Delhi, which is the capital of the country, we have had a relatively good summer, depending on which point of view you take, because it's been raining, the temperatures haven't gone up. The agriculturists, of course, have complained bitterly. But even in this year, we are seeing 4 to 5 hours of power cuts in the city of Delhi. The per capita electricity consumption is still significantly lower than even the world average. I would not even provide a comparison with the U.S. And you know, that's where the reality of the situation, in a sense, lies. If I come back for a minute to the future once again, and I am going to go back and forth a bit. This is the trend that we were concerned about on where India is heading. Total primary energy consumption we estimate would increase by a factor of 7 to 8 in the short period of 30 years. And coal, as I mentioned, would remain dominant. But despite that, if we look at where we would be by the year 2031 on some key parameters, it would seem to indicate that we probably need to do significantly better than what we are seeing in the business as usual scenario. Per capita steel consumption levels in India would be just about what we have as the world average, a little above what we have as the world average today, and what China is consuming today, once again, way behind some of the more advanced countries or rapidly developing countries like Korea as well. In the context of cement consumption, you see a much more significant increase in consumption of cement. And this, again, I think is reflective of the fact that we are expecting almost 11 to 12% increase in the average annual growth in the construction sector in the country. And that's one of the main reasons why there is an enormous focus on the construction industry in India. If you look at it in terms of electricity and motorized transportation demands, the first chart on the left is talking about passenger transport requirements in 1,000 kilometers. And we'll see that in the context of India, this is again going to increase fairly rapidly. And this is the second major focus where we are again trying to see how we can prevent a large percentage of our population becoming used to private modes of transportation by having major programs, and I'll come back to it in a minute, on expanding the public transport infrastructure that I was ruining a little while earlier. The electricity consumption per capita would still remain, as I mentioned, below the world average in 2004. We would have, despite the sevenfold rate of increase or eightfold rate of increase in the sector, on a per capita basis, this would come to 2,200 units. Hopefully, that should be good enough, but in terms of actual consumption, it is not that high. Carbon intensity of the Indian economy has been reducing, and it's reduced fairly significantly from 2001 to 2006, and then we expect it to go significantly lower by the year 2011, after which it kind of starts tapering out, which is also reflecting the fact that the technological choices that we see available to us today are kind of plateauing by that time frame. So we really need to have a significant improvement that becomes available on the energy-efficient technologies front. The key issue, the way India looks at it, is one of energy security. Now, it's both energy security concerns and climate security concerns do converge, but for us, because of the reasons that I've highlighted thus far, energy security takes predominance, and that is what is reflected, I guess, in the Indian government's situation. By the year 2031, the year that I've been discussing in my presentation, we would have to resort to coal imports of almost 1.5 billion tons. Today we have just about 100 million tons of coal imports. This would result in a coal import dependency of close to 80% for the country. And this is huge. For thus far, we have lived on the premise that India had abundant resources of coal and would continue meeting most of our requirements on the basis of domestic coal. But we are very clearly seeing a need for moving to imported coal. Oil imports have always been very high, but we expect this import dependency to go up to almost 95%, and we're talking about a staggering 680 million tons of oil imports. That would be needed. I'm not even beginning to say that these kinds of resources would be available to the country and at what price they would be available. This is what would be needed if we are to sustain an 8% rate of growth of the economy, which is what we were targeting. And gas imports, of course, would again would be pretty high and would lead to an import dependency level of about 67% for the country. So here is where the energy vulnerability is viewed by the Government of India. Having looked at that business as usual scenario in the modeling exercises that have been undertaken in TERI, we have run a very large number of alternative scenarios, and the purpose of showing you all these various charts and the line that is running right at the bottom of both these charts on energy intensity and CO2 emissions intensity is the hybrid scenario that incorporates all the options that we have for fuel substitution, for energy efficiency, for bringing in nuclear, for greater role of renewables, etc. Shows that there is a significant potential that exists for India to move to a low carbon pathway. But I guess, once again, the challenge remains on how are we going to do that, would the technologies be available, and do we have the necessary investments to make in it. And with those kinds of a redefinition of the pathway, there would be not only a carbon impact, as I showed, but also a huge fuel security impact, energy security impact, and we see that the import requirements of almost all fuels come down quite substantially from a business-as-usual scenario to the hybrid scenario, which is the second column for each of the fuels that we are talking about. Mr. Chairman, if you could let me know when I have just about 2 or 3 minutes left. Yeah. So some of the current initiatives that we are taking in the country are reflecting what we have just seen painted as a picture as it exists today and is going to emerge in the future. There's been reference made to the Integrated Energy Policy document, and there are various provisions in this document, which, by the way, has not yet been ratified by the government. So it's still under discussion. It still needs to be formally adopted as a policy. But basically, it recognizes the importance of energy efficiency in all sectors. There's a huge emphasis on mass transport systems, renewables, almost everything that we would like to see in an integrated energy policy document. What it does not address is how are we going to operationalize it? Because the biggest challenge that we have had in our country is the fact that we have 6 or 7 different ministries that are dealing with different subjects, energy subjects, and the level of coordination that exists between these ministries is nothing to talk about. We set up the Energy Coordination Committee that was headed by the Prime Minister about a year ago, but unfortunately they have not done very much. Other key policies and actions, there's been a major emphasis on bringing about reforms. And once again, there are some positives and some negatives in the energy sector reforms that we have followed. The positives, the way I would look at it, I'm not going to read through this bullet points that we have over here. But the positives, the way I look at it, is that it has created much better consumer awareness, and there is a demand today from consumers for good quality energy supply, which did not exist a decade and a half ago. And there is much more transparency in the manner in which prices are set, especially for the electricity sector, and there's a greater involvement of all stakeholders. The negative is that most of the state regulatory commissions that have been set up still follow staffing practices that are very suspect. I would be very wary of the decisions taken by several of the regulatory commissions because they have not been able to establish the credibility that they need to get the process rolling. We have a rural electrification policy and a major program that the government has announced. Let me try this on you. It's called the Rajiv Gandhi Grameen Vidyutkaran Yojana, RGGVY, which is a rural electrification program which aims to provide 100% electricity connection to all households in the country by the year 2012. It's very clear that we are not going to be able to meet that particular program objective. But even if we meet it by the year 2015 or 2017, I think that would be huge progress made. And there are enormous incentive programs that the government has announced to allow this to happen. There's also a major emphasis on the use of renewables for decentralized distributed generation options, which may make this possible if we move forward in the right way. Energy Conservation Act was passed in 2001. It did not have a head till 2006. But now, hopefully, things will move forward. And under the National Action Plan on Climate Change that was announced end of June, there has been a renewed emphasis on the role that the energy conservation body that we have, the Bureau of Energy Efficiency, would play from here on, and hopefully things should move on this front. There is a new and renewables energy policy that was announced to promote the use of renewables, but more recently, the government has also announced a major solar program that incentivizes substantially all those project developers that would like to set up power generating capacity based on solar power above a capacity of 1 megawatt. So they have announced price incentives for this purpose, which hopefully should once again provide a huge impetus to solar power, both thermal and photovoltaic in the country. Biodiesel purchase policy has set a minimum price for biodiesel in particular, and that, of course, would need to be reviewed now in the context of international oil prices, but it remains at 25 rupees a liter. But beyond that, there was overall biofuels policy that the government was supposed to announce, but that has now been put in cold storage for the time being, largely because of the international oil prices and also because of the tremendous amount of debate around biofuels that is taking place all over the world and is finding also reverberations in India. Ethanol blending of gasoline has been mandated, but it is also at the same time already admitted that we are not going to be able to do this. Energy conservation building codes have been put in place from 2006. There is a mandatory energy efficiency code for all buildings with greater than 500 kVA connected load or conditioned floor area of 1,000 square meters. Going beyond this, the Ministry of Environment and Forests has also come out with some notifications that require buildings of smaller sizes and smaller occupancy to also go through a stringent environmental check that includes energy. So on the energy front in buildings, I think there's a lot that is being done in the country. I'm not going to go through some of these, but major focus on introduction of CFLs, a large emphasis on developing hydropower and great incentives that are being given, but at the same time, once again, a lot of questioning and public outcry that is beginning to happen on hydropower once again. So that is going to remain a challenge as we move forward. Wind, we have almost 8,000, a little over 8,000 megawatts of wind capacity that has already been established. Solar PVs I've mentioned. Biomass, gasifiers, biogas, etc. are still very, very small and are probably not getting the kind of attention that they deserve, especially the biomass-based technologies that we are talking about. And very quickly on this National Action Plan on Climate Change that was announced on 30th of June, there, apart from recognizing the fact that development comes first, but that development needs to be climate sensitive, etc., the government has announced 8 missions to deal with specific aspects of the climate change problem that covers both mitigation and adaptation options. And these include this national solar mission that I made reference to earlier. There's a national mission on enhanced energy efficiency, a mission on sustainable habitats that includes looking at buildings, that includes looking at urban transport systems, waste-to-energy projects, and so on. A national water mission that recognizes India's huge vulnerability on account of the waterfront. A national mission for sustaining the Himalayan ecosystem, once again recognizing the fact that the glaciers in the Himalayas are very vulnerable and it would have a significant impact on a whole range of activities in the country. National Mission for a Green India, we already have a target of putting about 33% of our land area under forests, which has been there for a very long while now. But we have about 14 to 15% that is currently under forest cover. There will be a huge impetus provided to this, and we'd like to see all the 33% coming under forest cover. National Mission on Sustaining Agriculture, once again recognizing the huge vulnerability of this particular sector and seeing what kinds of interventions need to be put in place so that we are able to minimize the impact of climate change on agriculture and on farmers in particular. And a National Mission on Strategic Knowledge for Climate Change, recognizing once again the fact that there's very little scientific research models, etc., that has been done in the country on climate change. So hopefully all of these should put us on the right track, both on mitigation and adaptation, and help us go forward on this. And that's what I wanted to share with you for this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was an excellent presentation and brought together many of the pieces that I think will generate a lot of questions that move forward. The next speaker is Ted Jones, and Ted is substituting at the last minute, so I'm sure he's feeling under some pressure here for Ron Summers. Ted is the director for the Energy and Civilian Nuclear Initiative at the U.S.-India Business Council. He's been working there at the Council as the Director for Policy Advocacy and Business Development, responsible for the work on the U.S.-India Civil Nuclear Initiative and corporate social responsibilities. He joined the U.S.-India Business Council after working in public affairs at Skadden Arps and working towards a Georgetown law degree now. About finished? Is that right? Okay. So Ted, do you want to...
Thank you, David. I won't even attempt to channel Ron Summers today. Those of you who know him know that would require me to like develop my own energy source, plugging myself into an outlet maybe. I don't have 12 years of on-the-ground experience in the energy sector as Ron does in India. So maybe I could just share with you some things that U.S.-India Business Council is working on that I'm working on in energy and Maybe we could have a little time for some questions and discussion. I don't know what the agenda requires. What I explained to Tezzi that I've been working on is a paper requested by the U.S. Trade Representative on a few key areas that U.S. government can advocate policy changes to increase U.S. investment in India's energy sector. We chose three areas to focus on for this. One, upstream oil and gas. Second, natural gas distribution. And third, power. And for this, we consulted our members to see in each of these areas what their difficulties are and what kind of changes would unlock greater investment. As many of you know, India has promoted exploration and production in oil and gas through licensing rounds under the new Exploration Licensing Policy, or NELP, framework. Between 2001 and 2006, the government awarded 162 oil and natural gas concessions in six licensing rounds. The third just concluded last month. The latest round put on offer 19 blocks, attracting 89 bids. But for the exception of a few new entrants, it didn't attract many new foreign companies. And in fact, ONGC and other Indian national oil companies predominated in the bidding, just as they have in the past. It was very weak bidding. 12 blocks out of the 57 failed to get a single bid, and 19 got just one bid. ExxonMobil, Chevron, Total, and Shell, among many others, preferred to stay away. The weak participation in this NELP round continues a long trend. Today, only three non-Indian companies, Cairn Energy, British Gas, and NECO, are active in the upstream energy market. Consultation with the leading U.S. oil exploration and production companies with experience in India suggests a few reasons for the ebbing interest. Weak geological prospects in these NELP blocks were cited by all of the companies as a leading reason for refraining. However, these companies are all interested in looking in India, and the weak geological prospects, which are compounded by some weak seismological data and better prospects elsewhere, were not the final reason for the weak participation. The single most important reason cited by U.S. companies for passing over the NELP opportunities is the lack of market-based pricing for downstream petroleum products. These companies noted that heavy subsidies of refined fuel products undermine the new market-determined price mechanism. They point out that large subsidies to the national oil companies distort market signals and disadvantage private investors. These companies agree that if the government would simply promulgate a roadmap towards truly market-based pricing, confidence in the Indian market would rise. International interest in NELP also suffered a setback in the withdrawal of the income tax holiday for gas production. This just happened in the latest budget. And this new policy not only diminished the incentive for exploration, it also left oil companies confused as to how to structure their bids, given that oil and gas are often found together, and the holiday remains in effect for oil production. The Petroleum Ministry postponed the deadline for bids three times in hope of gaining clarity from the Finance Ministry, but it never came, and I think this probably made things much worse than they would otherwise have been. A third deterrent to participation by international oil majors is that the bid criteria didn't assign adequate weight to the capability and technical competence of the bidders. Particularly regarding deep water exploration, and many of the bids in the latest round were deep water, oil majors have unparalleled expertise. Recently, the government was forced to seize five deepwater blocks that had previously been awarded to a domestic company because the company had failed to complete the required studies, processing, and drilling on time. A related problem is the perception among some international oil companies that India's domestic firms have received favorable treatment by the government, such as in the recent extension of some leases for a leading domestic company. International oil companies have also noted a few other things. The government authorities have been unusually intrusive in the oversight of exploration blocks. They're accustomed to more flexible systems with a heavier emphasis on capability. And finally, the companies have expressed a desire for a single window clearance for all regulatory approvals. This would enable exploration and production companies to more quickly mobilize their resources and speed up their pace of operations. With the production and consumption gap just widening in India, it's important that India do better in its domestic production. I think that the gap has really yawned open in the last 28 years. Since 1990, it has grown. Consumption has grown 9 times faster than production. So, U.S.-India Business Council would urge India to heed some of these remarks by the oil majors and NELP 8 perhaps attract a lot more interest. The second area we looked at was natural gas distribution. In September 2008, Reliance Industries will begin producing from one of the largest natural gas discoveries in recent years. The gas from this find, located in the Krishna Godavari Basin in the Bay of Bengal, will virtually double India's existing natural gas production when it reaches full capacity in 2010. Reliance's transnational pipeline from Kakinada, Andhra Pradesh, to the company's Jamnagar refinery in Gujarat promises to radiate commercial opportunities along its 900-mile length in power generation, city gas distribution, fertilizer manufacture, and more. The legal regimes that govern the use of this pipeline by users and by other producers are still evolving. How they develop will play a critical role in attracting ancillary investments and in the development of India. How the gas will be allocated by the government, which has the authority to set marketing priorities, is a fundamental. In a press note just last month, the Ministry of Petroleum and Natural Gas has granted highest priority to the nation's 22 existing fertilizer manufacturers. They will be entitled to sufficient gas feedstock to operate at full capacity. Next in priority are liquefied natural gas plants, which will receive up to 97 million cubic feet per day, power plants up to 581 million cubic feet per day, and then city gas distribution projects for household use and transportation, which will get 161 million cubic feet per day. The government has already decided to provide gas to all cities with population over 2.5 million within the next 3 years, and at present 12 cities in India have that size. The government also retains authority to price natural gas. Unlike the administered price of gas pumped by state-run ONGC, Reliance's gas will be sold at a price linked to market rates, though significantly lower. Gas from the KG field has been priced at $4.2 per million BTUs, less than the 4.5 Reliance had sought. And to compare, on the NYMEX market, natural gas futures for August delivery are above $13 per million BTUs. One likely effect of the cheap gas, which is 80% cheaper than the world crude oil equivalent, will be a shift from petroleum products in many applications. The area of focus that we have taken after speaking with our members is on the Petroleum and Natural Gas Regulatory Board. We're really concerned that this gain more sufficient and flexible powers to enforce the laws and regulations, as well as to fairly settle disputes between industry participants. And whether that happens remains to be seen. USIBC members are also concerned that it be endowed with sufficient skilled and unbiased staff and resources, and not secondees from related public sector companies to do the job required by law. The last section we've looked at is power. In generation, India is seeking to add 110,000 megawatts to its existing installed generating capacity of 134,000 megawatts over the next several years. With 18,000 megawatts of unmet demand and strong economic growth prospects for decades to come, India should be a great opportunity for independent power producers. But since Dabhol and other troublesome projects, few power companies have ventured there. Recently, the American power giant AES signed MOUs with the governments of Chhattisgarh and Orissa to to set up two 1,200-megawatt capacity coal-based power plants. Today, AES has the only significant American investments in India in downstream power production. The manner in which AES has dealt with the challenges in India's power market illustrates the barriers and opportunities confronting U.S. power developers. India's power sector presents some very difficult challenges for developers. Average tariffs are significantly below the cost of supplying power, particularly for the agriculture sector. Technical line losses are among the highest in the world, and theft of power is widespread. The transmission and distribution network has limited capacity between regions of the country, and state electricity boards have had difficulty in meeting their payment obligations under long-term power purchase agreements. The vast majority of non-captive new generation is owned by the central government or a state government. The Electricity Act of 2003, which enabled independent power producers to contract with alternate purchasers in the event of a default by a state electricity board, has not allayed developers' concerns about payment security. Unreliable transmission grids limit the market for alternative buyers. The mechanism has also not yet been tested by a significant project, and doubts continue to hound its viability to mitigate risk. Difficulties in acquiring reliable fuel supplies create further risk for the developer. Essentially, AES has bet that the growing power demand creates an attractive opportunity for India as well, in that states which support power development will be rewarded with greater installed capacity and greater development. So, stable and business-friendly government was one of AES's principal considerations guiding the choice of Orissa and Chhattisgarh. The people at AES we've spoken with have explained that land acquisition and forest clearances are always time-consuming, but they have received a lot of cooperation from the authorities in those states. The most decisive consideration, of course, for siting in Orissa and Chhattisgarh was the availability of coal. Access to reliable fuel in quality and quantity is a growing problem across India, as coal production has fallen increasingly short of demand in recent years, and rail transport remains unreliable. In both states, AES has acquired blocks to mine coal for captive use in its power plants. This is not actually a final paper. It's something that we are continuing to consult with our member companies about, and we really welcome ideas to what could further deepen in trade and investment in these areas. It's also not the limit of what we are advocating in energy either. We are really interested to explore the opportunities for U.S. companies in non-conventional energy, renewables, and nuclear power as well. Many of you know that U.S. India Business Council has played an active role in advocating civilian nuclear cooperation. We created a committee 2.5 years ago, shortly after the July 18, 2005 summit with Manmohan Singh and President Bush, to push for a change in U.S. law, which culminated in 2006 with the Hyde Act. And we've monitored the situation for over a year now since the Indian government pulled back last fall. And so there's a lot of encouraging news in the last several days, as many of you have seen. We're very hopeful that that's going to move forward, and we're kind of reorganizing ourselves to push for it. Its consummation here in Washington, should we get that opportunity. We know that it has to go through the IAEA and the NSG and do so in a quick enough pace that it could actually get back to Washington, D.C. in time to for U.S. Congress to deal with it before it recesses at the end of September. So I think I'll just stop here and allow any further questions.
Okay, we do have time, is that right, Tessie, for some questions from the floor. In keeping with the convention here at CSIS, we'd ask that the questioners identify themselves and who are they with, and even if they have a statement to make, if they could end it with some kind of question that could be answered, it would be quite helpful. But short. But I was going to take the prerogative and perhaps develop a little further on Ted's last comments on the nuclear agreement, because I think that in many ways is dominating interest here. And perhaps, Dr. Srivastava, you had mentioned it at the beginning, but do you have any perceptions on the outlook politically? But then the other question is the one of the importance of a nuclear agreement to solving the energy challenge, as you put on the chart, because in many ways, I don't think I saw nuclear as a part of those solutions. So I think perhaps if you could address those, that would be helpful. And Ted, if you want to add on to your comments.
Thank you. Yes, I did miss that. As far as the outlook for the civil nuclear cooperation deal is concerned, I would think that on the Indian side, there is already a commitment. Dr. Manmohan Singh has put his job on the block by going ahead and sending the draft agreement to IAEA and taking up the issue at the G8 as well. So I think the Indian government is definitely committed to it. I do recognize the fact that time is very short, but given the fact that this process has been going on for so long, I'm still hopeful that things would be doable in a sense on the U.S. side as well. So I feel very optimistic about the nuclear deal going through. I did not mention too much about it in my presentation for the primary reason that in the time frame that I was talking about, which is up to 2030, one is not seeing a very major contribution that nuclear energy will be able to play for a variety of reasons. I mean, the way I look at it, at best, we can possibly talk about, which is significant, but in the overall context, it is not significant. We can talk about maybe 25,000 megawatts coming up between now and 2020 or so, which is huge, and if that goes up to, on an optimistic scale, once again, 60 to 70,000 megawatts by the year 2030, in terms of total contribution to the overall electricity generation capacity in the country, it would be 7 to 8%. But in absolute numbers, it is huge. And I'm not sure if that would happen, you know, because one is the whole issue of technology and fuel, of course, and if we take a very optimistic scenario and assume that we are able to solve all of this, the issue of sheer human capacity and capabilities, which have disappeared over a period of time because no significant nuclear generating capacity has really been set up. It's very limited in the country. I'm sure it's very limited in several other countries as well. So that would need to be built up. But most important, you know, and of course the availability of the equipment, but most important is where are we going to set it up? And that is a big issue that we'll have to see how it plays out.
I'll just add a couple of points on this side. There's a couple of things that could stop it on this side. The most formidable, obviously, is time. We now have just a limited number of days left in the congressional calendar. Our lobbyist at Patton Boggs, who followed this very closely, just conducted an analysis that concluded that it is very viable, however. A lot of the time requirements stipulated in the Hyde Act have been mentioned by some as reasons this couldn't get done. Those requirements are waivable if Congress opts to do so, and we're hopeful that if this goes through the IAEA and NSG, that that it'll have enough momentum that the champions of the deal on our side, and there are many, with it having passed 8215 in the Senate and 359-68 in the House, there are many supporters that would like to see it done. Obviously, the administration would like to see it done. The second problem over here is that it could somehow become a political football in an election season. But I think the probability of that is actually quite small. Just hours ago, I saw that Obama had a statement out supporting the nuclear deal and opposing further changes to it, which is very encouraging. And there are some big champions on the Democratic side of the aisle on Capitol Hill, including Senator Biden. So we're confident that that's not going to be a problem.
So I hear a lot of confidence, and that's a good thing. So questions, please.
Thank you. I'm Leonard Oberlander, independent consultant. I'd like to ask about, in the power sector, what is some of the competition that U.S.-India development is facing, specifically with India being an associate member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, one of the cornerstones of which is economic and development cooperation. Are U.S. companies like AES facing competition, for instance, from in the energy generation sector and delivery, from far extension of a foreign grid, for instance, a Russian grid, to India and power supplied by the Bashir? This is something that I've read about plans for doing that, but not from India's side, but from the from Russian side, and also the coal sector, which you mentioned lacks rail transportation. How in the timetable for development of use of coal, as that use expands, will the coal get from its source to the place where it would be used? And lastly, what is the competition for foreign investment in India in developing power generation facilities and transport facilities and pipelines? Thank you.
Well, that's pretty good. You got three questions. That's who would like to take on the first one in terms of the regional?
To the coal transport question, I'll take that first. We have the problem is you either have to build a plant at the mine, and then you evacuate the power, or you move the coal and to the power plant that's more conveniently sited. I think Mike Gabbaugh could probably speak about this better than anybody, having represented GE, but. That's the central problem, as I understand it, and it's neither one of those has an easy solution. I do know that AES has had some strong competition, including Chinese competition, as have the Indian power developers faced a lot of competition from China.
Okay. I'm not sure I got the first question exactly right, but my sense is that on the issue of competition, yes, I think there is not so much on setting up of power generating capacities to carry forward what Ted said, but I think on equipment, there is a fair degree of competition that is coming from China in particular. And even in the setting up of power plants, you know, so the whole technical capacities in a sense. So I think there's a lot on that front. As far as extension of grids is concerned, there was some talk about extending electricity lines across the Himalayan region into India as well, but I don't think that we have come to a conclusion that is techno-economically feasible as yet. So there's not too much movement on that. It is often put forward also in the hope that, you know, we would be able to access some resources in the form of electricity, you know, because we're not able to move the gas or coal that we would like to have in the country. So that is, but I'm not seeing, for India at least, that movement through the electrical route as a key option. On the other hand, if we talk about, and just digressing a little bit to the gas pipelines issues, the Iran-Pakistan-India pipeline, which has been on the back burner for a very long time, we've been talking about it on and off, but no conclusion on it, is now evinced some interest in China. So the Pakistanis are holding this out and saying, if you don't come on the table fast enough, you're going to move this gas into China and bypass India. So these kinds of things do keep happening in the region, but I'm not sure how serious most of this is. Coal movements is a key problem within the country. I would have liked to say that it's a priority sector and therefore, coal required to be moved to power plants would get the railway capacity that we are looking for moving. But it's also a fact that in the last couple of years in particular, several of our power plants have run with coal stocks as low as 3 days. So that's really critical. And some of it was due to the railways. A large part of it is due to the railway movement. So this is an area of major concern. But one way or the other, it does get addressed because we don't want the power plants to be going down. It creates a huge problem. But it does give tensions, for sure, for the power plants. Your last question was on competition once again. Foreign investors, we're not seeing too many of them currently in the power sector. A lot of competition there, but what we are seeing is the emergence of a number of Indian players, apart from Reliance, which is one of the better known kinds of entities. I mean, the GVKs and the GMRs and the Tatas, of course, are doing extremely well on the power side in particular, on the generation side. And most of them have changed their business strategy to focus on generation rather than look at the distribution end of the business.
I'm Namrata Patodia with the Pew Center on Global Climate Change. Ms. Srivastava, you mentioned the National Action Plan on Climate Change. And I was interested in what sort of responses people in India and otherwise have got on the plan, and if you can just shed some light on that, specifically in relation to the fact that there are no specific targets and timetables within the plan. You mentioned that there's a biodiesel purchase policy and or the biodiesel plan, you know, things that the government of India intends to do but constantly puts it on the back burner and doesn't necessarily end up implementing it. So I just wanted to get your sense of, you know, what do you think, how implementable is the action plan, and what is the implementing plan since there are no targets and timetables? And if you can also highlight, there seemed to be the absence of carbon capture and storage. Specifically, coal is going to be one of the primary sources going forward till 2031 within the Integrated Energy Policy 2006 document, and I was curious as to why that is missing, considering climate change is becoming such a big issue. Thank you.
The response to the National Action Plan on Climate Change was generally favorable, but I think there was a great degree of concern on the point that you raised, that there was not a mention of any targets. But having said that about disappointment on the part of NGOs, et cetera, I still think that the action plan is a great step forward in recognizing the importance of climate change. I think the value of the document lies more in the message that it sends within the country amongst the various ministries of the Government of India and the state and local governments in terms of climate-sensitive development, in terms of the need to start looking at strategies by which we can move to a low-carbon pathway, and also, of course, to look at adaptation very importantly. So I think it's an equally important internal communication document as it is from an external communication point of view. Carbon capture and sequestration, I'm not sure exactly what the document could say. I presume that the last mission that is talking about adding to scientific knowledge would address itself to this particular issue, but there is very little experience thus far in the international arena to really give the kind of confidence that we require for this purpose. So I'm not surprised not to see that over there. What the document says would happen is that each of these missions would be put in place under the respective line ministries, and there would be, again, a whole range of ministries. And by December 2008, each of the missions is supposed to come out with a strategy on how they are going to take forward the work of each mission. So we all have an opportunity to provide an input between now and 2008 in the next 6 months to defining the path that these missions would take.
And that would involve more specific time?
That would involve more specific actions that the government would put in place, yes.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question, so I'll take from this table here.
Gross, Northrop Grumman. My question probably should go to Lena Srivastava, and it concerns what I would term the Ayurvedic solution to India's renewable energy dilemma. There's a small company in Bangalore that claims to have cornered the market on a plant called Jatropha, they say that it's an inedible plant, grows anywhere. And I wondered if you'd heard much about it. I understand that all the buses in Bangalore are currently running on Jatropha oil.
Your information is quite right. Jatropha is a non-edible plant. We are actually also experimenting we have an action or research demonstration project on Jatropha on about 8,000 hectares of land to the east of Bangalore in the state of Andhra Pradesh. So it is a very hardy plant. It can grow in low water conditions and high stress conditions. Of course, the productivity levels vary, etc. That's a plant for which, as I was mentioning, one of the plants that would lead to biodiesel output, 25 rupees a liter is the minimum support price that the government of India has offered on it. There are several unresolved questions on it. I mean, the assumption is that huge tracts of wasteland would be available in the country for growing Jatropha, which is unsubstantiated. And, from what we have seen on this research demonstration project that we have been engaged in, is that almost every piece of land, no matter how poor it is in quality, has been allocated to some poor farmer or the other for purposes of sustenance farming. So, you cannot expect then these farmers to put their land under Jatropha plantation because you're really saying you wait for 5 years to get the yields from it, and in the meanwhile, how you survive is your own problem. It's a big challenge, and we don't know what are the environmental implications of growing large-scale Jatropha plantations. What would a monoculture of this kind, if we are indeed talking about large blocks of lands, due to the environment, etc. So I think there are a number of unanswered questions that remain. But having said that, because of the price that is offered and in expectation of a higher price, a large number of farmers have already started growing Jatropha on their land and, using the market as it exists. There has also been reports that one consignment of biodiesel has been exported from the country off the shores of Kerala into Europe. But again, if you speak to people in the government, they would deny it and say that, this is not happening and it's probably a cover for something else and so on. But there is a fair degree of interest in it.
Great. Well, I want to thank both Dr. Srivastava and Ted Jones for their presentations here. I think they were excellent. And would you please join me in a round of applause?